accession number 11767, reel 2.
Admiral Mills, reel 2.
The only really significant one, I suppose, that I can remember was when Captain Walker, Johnny Walker, as he was always known as, returned as in his escort group, having sunk, I can't quite remember whether it was 4 or was it 5 U-boats in the convoy from Gibraltar, I think it was. But this exemplifies one point of interest to my observation as a staff officer, was that there tended to be two kinds of senior officers of convoy escort groups, which is what they were, and each escort group had its own senior officer, who was normally a captain. There was the senior officer of the group, who of course was responsible for routing the convoy, who went out of his way to avoid the U-boats, and there was one in particular that I can remember called Captain Couchman, who subsequently became an admiral. And he, I think, almost never had any direct contact with U-boats because he was exceedingly wise and able to steer a route which he based on the intelligence that he received, which avoided U-boats. And that was his object. Whereas Captain Walker, who's extremely good and able at sinking U-boats with his group, tended more to go through areas where there were U-boats so that he could sink them. And there were these two very definite categories into which these various senior officers fell.
Which do you think was the wisest policy?
I think you probably wanted both, to be quite honest. People have often asked me that question, and I think that obviously it was a good thing to be able to sink some U-boats, and at the same time it was obviously a good thing to be able to steer merchant ships away from U-boats, and I think that there is a great deal to be said for both.
Was there anybody at the headquarters or anybody you came across who thought the whole convoy system idea was wrong?
I don't think I ever met anyone who thought that was wrong, no. Every now and then these questions were asked and thought was given to it, and there were, of course, the independent sailings, but they were almost always faster ships like the Queen Mary and Co., who sailed by themselves and relied on their high speed to get through, which I'm happy to say they did. But I don't think there was any serious thought given to doing away with the convoy system. It had, of course, alterations and different formations, and there were changes in our own organisation, and towards the end of my time at Liverpool, we were able to have enough ships to provide what we called support groups. And of course Captain Walker was given command of one of these because their job was not to be tied to specific convoys as escorts, but to go where support was needed against U-boats. And in some cases, I suppose, aircraft.
Why do you think Walker himself was so good?
He was a wonderful leader and a tremendous appreciation of what he thought the enemy would do. And he had a great intuition for getting to grips with the U-boat and success usually managing to sink or capture them.
Did you get to know him?
I knew him. I never went to sea with him. I certainly knew him because I would see him every time he came into harbour and again before he sailed, and once or twice while they were in Liverpool in between convoys I would see him. I would only be a very junior officer in the organisation, of course, but I did see him because of my job with the signals.
What was his personality like?
He was a tremendous, tremendously energetic man, was always ready to be on the bridge and there for hours and hours and hours on end, of course. He was a man of tremendous charm, and he built up a wonderful sense of support and discipline too in his escort group, and by the end, of course, it was almost, as far as he was concerned, hero worshipping, you see, the sailors, not only in his own ship but in his group collectively of however many he had at the time, sometimes four, sometimes five, six of frigates or sloops and corvettes. So all the sailors worshipped him and had tremendous confidence in him, because success is a great thing when you're in command at sea, and everybody's always happy to go along with success, obviously.
Who was your own boss at Liverpool?
My own boss, for most of the time I was there, it was a very experienced destroyer commander called McCoy, Captain McCoy. Very able and experienced. So I think he probably would rather have been in one of the ships commanding one of them out at sea, but that didn't detract from his great ability to administer and to look after these ships. And he was there very nearly all my time there. For a short time, there was another one called Captain Stevens, E.B.K. Stevens. He also was an experienced destroyer officer. And he then left, and he went, I think he went to Newfoundland, where we set up a base for the escorts, which went over to Newfoundland. And as far as I remember, he went there.
Did you see anything of the Blitz on Liverpool?
Yes, I did, although not a lot, because Bootle was a little way out Liverpool, and there were attacks on Gladstone Dock, which is in Bootle, which is where all our ships were berthed, but they were nearly always at night. And I lived out, I was billeted really, as a sort of paying guest, bed and breakfast in a little town outside called Hightown. And this was really outside the Liverpool bombing area, and I wasn't in Liverpool itself hardly ever when there was any actual bombing, because it was nearly all at night, and I was out in Hightown. Once or twice when I was in Liverpool, there were one or two, but very small incidents during the day.
How do you spell Hightown?
H-I-G-H-T-O-W-N.
This is not that.
It's Hightown. Just a small suburb, but it was just, it was easy for me because it was close by, and I was put on to some people who lived there. We had to find our own accommodation.
What did public morale seem to be like in Liverpool under the bombing?
Very good during the time when I was there. Of course, it got much more serious after I had left, I suppose. But the morale was always good. I didn't see anything else during the time that I was there.
I think that after this job you were involved in the planning of Operation Torch.
That's quite right. In August 42, was it? I was relieved, and I didn't know what I was going to do, but I was told to go to London and report to Norfolk House. in St. James's Square, which I did, and there I found that planning had fairly recently started for a landing of British and American troops in and around Algiers. I was in Norfolk House for quite some time with the signal planning staff. My boss was one Commander de Lacca, who subsequently became an admiral, and we were doing the plans for the landing from August until we sailed, which I suppose was towards the end of October. And that was a fairly active period, and things were happening fairly quickly, and I was concerned with helping with the signal planning for the operation. And then I had originally been going to go as the signal officer to a commodore called Graham to take part in the easternmost landings, which were to be at Bone. And then it was decided, I don't really know by whom, but by the higher command, that it was too far east and it was too dangerous to land at Bone. It certainly was nothing to do with the British Admiral, who became the commander, Admiral Cunningham, A.B. Cunningham, as he was known as, although he didn't take over until shortly before the operation. The naval admiral in charge of the planning was Admiral Ramsay. And if you look in Admiral Cunningham's book called A Sailor's Odyssey, you will find that he says, which was a quote from his report of proceedings, that he will always be sorry we weren't bolder and didn't land at Bone. And in the end, because that landing didn't take place, they didn't seem to have anything very much for me to do during the operation, so I was sent as a liaison officer in one of the American troop transports, which was in charge of one sector of the landing of American troops, because they wanted me to make sure that the overall British commander could get in touch with the commanders of this sector of the landing. And I went out in the convoy, in the ship, in the leading convoy, and we did the landings just to the east of Algiers on the beaches as designated. And then when that was over, I became the base signal officer at Algiers.
What was the landing like? Can you describe it?
I would have to say that the landing was successful, really, because in our sector, virtually no opposition. But I would have to say, by comparison with the British organization and the British landing, it was perhaps a bit of a shambles. The Americans were not as precisely organized as we were to touch down exactly the appointed hour, and with the same detailed control that our command had over our landing craft and landing organization generally. But, of course, the Americans, with their infinite resources, which they had, and I would have to admit, too, that we none of us had very much experience of this sort of thing at that time. Combined operations was very new. But they got by. They had plenty of landing craft and plenty in reserve, and they landed the troops on the designated beaches.
When you say shambles, you mean it was chaotic?
Well, I mean it was a bit chaotic at times. There were landing craft buzzing around the ship all over the place, and not not proceeding quite in accordance with the time schedule. But they had enough resources and they did what was required of them at the time.
Were there collisions and casualties?
No, not casualties from collisions, no, but just not as tidily and well organized into groups of landing craft and things as those went from our ships. But I think they had even less experience of combined operations at that time than we had, and we certainly didn't have very much.
And there was very little opposition from the enemy?
There was in our sector, yes. In the area of Algiers, there was a bit more perhaps at Oran, where we were not, but the destroyers that went into the harbour very early on, they met with some nasty opposition and they had some casualties, but where we were, which was not right into the harbour, it was a little to the east of Algiers, there was no opposition to speak of. The nearest we came to opposition, I suppose, was during the approach when we were still to the west of Algiers. Somewhere the night before was when one ship did have a hit, but it didn't sink it, it just did some damage from a torpedo, which was obviously fired from a U-boat during the night. But that was not the ship that I was in, which was called Samuel Chase.
Were there any problems that you had in the planning stage at Norfolk House?
Well, I suppose the whole thing was a problem, really, in that we had to devise a special organisation for the convoys starting, as they did, many of them from up in the Clyde area, and one had to devise an organisation. There were headquarters ships, which we hadn't had before. They were small merchant ships taken and converted and filled with wireless sets for the command, because there was a great deal of command and control all the way and all the time, not only of the actual tactical handling of the convoys and their escorts, but also, of course, of the signals to and fro between the ships at sea and the command ashore, and any intelligence information that was provided. And I don't remember any sort of particular problem as being outstanding, but the whole organisation had to be one that was specially devised for the operation, which had to conform with what was our usual practice in ships then, whereby signals were made from shore on a broadcast system, which meant that the signals were not themselves answered individually, because obviously we did not want to break wireless silence. And so the whole organization had to be devised so that you could receive all the information you wanted in the ships without actually breaking wireless silence, except, of course, in emergency of attack or anything.
Do you yourself think that the landings should have been at Burn as well?
I would like to have done that. I think it might have hastened the army side of the operation a bit, but in the end the operations of the First Army were, which was the army that we landed, the British Army, were successful, if perhaps a little bit drawn out, but I think it might have speeded things up. But it's rather hypothetical, because one doesn't quite know what the opposition would have been. Had we been successful, then it undoubtedly would have hastened the operation. But I'm afraid we can't know whether we would have been successful or not.
Then you were in Algiers until March 1943.
And then I was in Algiers until March. And then I was there. At that time, they were just beginning to talk about the next operation, which was the landings in Sicily, which were known as Operation Husky. I remember. Our landings at Algiers had been known as Operation Torch, and the next one was Husky, and we were just beginning to talk about that, and I didn't know whether I would be involved or not as junior signal officer, but I was expecting to be when I was sent back home at short notice because a new training organization had been set up in the Western Approaches, and a training ship, which was a ship which used to be Sopwith's yacht, which was called Philanto. Sopwith used to do a lot of cruising in this large yacht and then go through the Panama Canal fishing in the Pacific. And this yacht was taken over by the Admiralty, and it was turned into a training ship for the Western Approaches. And the First Sea Lord at the time, I was told, had given instructions that whoever was wanted to go and help man this ship was to be provided. They were given priority because it happened to be a time when the Battle of the Atlantic was going badly. And I had been in the Western Approaches before, as we've discussed, at Liverpool. And a signal was sent that I was to go back again and join the Philanto. And Philanto I joined in charge of the signals. We were based at Larne in Northern Ireland, at the entrance to the Belfast Lock. And we took each escort group as it sailed from Liverpool, Greenock or Londonderry, came to us for 2 to 3 days for us to work up their communications and their tactics. And then they went off on their convoy escort duty into the Atlantic. And this was this yacht, ex-Sopwith owned yacht, was a perfectly good sort of headquarters ship. I had plenty of wireless sets installed in her, and I stayed there, as far as I remember, for about 6 months, helping to train these groups on their way out to the Atlantic. And I think that it helped the groups, because they came having been on leave since their previous convoy duty. And then they came, and they all sailed, and they came together in the Irish Sea. And for 48 hours, they could have a good workout together before going off into the Atlantic on escort duty.
I think that whilst you were on the Philanto, it was the time when the Battle of the Atlantic suddenly changed, the fortunes in the Battle of the Atlantic changed. Were you conscious of that sudden change?
It's perfectly true what you say, and it's very interesting. Like so many changes, I suppose, that have been in war, even towards the end of World War I, you remember things suddenly changed, and one didn't necessarily notice this happening, but it just happened, and it all seemed to happen quite quickly. And certainly one was conscious of it and one noticed it, but it would have been very difficult to put one's finger onto any one thing and say suddenly everything is going right, although it all happened very suddenly in the event.
Can we go on now to the preparations for the Normandy landing?
Yes, that's right. After my 6 months in Philanto, they then wanted a signal officer to go down to London who had been in combined operations before. Because you see, we were gaining experience all the time in these things, and there weren't always people available in the right theatre at the right time who had previous experience in some particular type of warfare. And because I'd had this experience with the torch landings in Algiers, and therefore I'd been in combined operations a bit, they asked for me to go join staff for what was subsequently called Operation Overlord, which was the Normandy landings. And so I went to London, once again to Norfolk House in St James's Square, although I did start for a short time at Combined Operations Headquarters. And I was the... there were two of us on the signal staff to start with. Commander Paul, who was subsequently in charge of all the naval communications for the operation. And I was with him from the word go of this planning. And we went to Norfolk House, and from starting, I suppose, in September, and the planning finished presumably when we landed, which was in June 1944, and I was really the assistant working closely with this commander in charge of all the naval communications during that time.
What was the atmosphere like in the preparation for the Second Front?
The atmosphere was one of tremendous confidence and, of course, great satisfaction that at last we really were going to land on the continent again and get to grips with the enemy nearer to home rather than... first of all, we had to land in Algiers, and then we went, you remember, to Sicily and Italy and on up, and there was tremendous expectancy and always confidence, perhaps more confidence when Monty arrived. I suppose we'd been there for two or three months when Monty was sent home from Italy to come and take command, as you remember, of the land forces in the Allied landing. And it then went from three, what we called assault areas, and he said that this wasn't enough and this wasn't good enough, and he went to the chiefs of staff, and he said there must be five. And so the landing assault areas went from three to five. They finished up with three British and two American, and there was a great air, an air of even greater confidence, I think, perhaps, from then onwards.
Did Montgomery come round to headquarters and meet you?
I didn't meet him during the actual planning which went on in Norfolk House. I did later on. We then went down as the landings approached. We moved to Southwark House at Portsmouth. I remember being sent down. I was the first one, because headquarters were to a very large extent governed by the communications, and I was sent down long before the Admiral had planned where he would go to Southwark Park, where we had a navigation school just behind Portsmouth, just over the downs from Portsmouth, and we had a navigation school there called Dryad, and this was a large private house, and I was sent down from this signal planning staff in Norfolk House